Logic of defense testimonies. Before passing to consideration of the activities of the Einsatzgruppen in Russia, it is convenient to review various statements made or allegedly made by various Nazis, mostly after the war, which explicitly or implicitly claim exterminations. An important category consists of statements made by German witnesses and defendants at the war crimes trials. In evaluating such statements, one must bear in mind the simple fact that the powers which conducted these trials were committed, as an immovable political fact, to the legend of Jewish extermination, especially in regard to Auschwitz. Their leaders had made the relevant charges long before they possessed a scrap of what is today called evidence. Thus, the courts were committed a priori to the extermination legend. A finding that exterminations had not occurred was simply not in the realm of political possibility at these trials, in any practical sense. This is an undeniable fact. On the other hand, with only a tiny handful of exceptions, the courts were not a priori committed on questions of personal responsibility of individuals. With respect to individuals, the courts were not as greatly constrained, politically speaking. In most cases, judgments of absence of personal responsibility were well within the realm of political possibility, as distinct from probability. All defense cases were organized in relation to these undeniably valid observations, and even with those individuals whose cases were hopeless, the lawyers had no choice but to proceed on the assumption that a favorable verdict was within the realm of the possible. In considering the trials from this point of view, it is very helpful to consider them chronologically. Joseph Kramer, Beast of Belsen. The first relevant trial was not the IMT but the Belsen trial, conducted by a British military court, of Germans who had been on the staff of the Belsen camp when it was captured. The commandant, SS Captain Joseph Kramer, the quote-unquote Beast of Belsen, was naturally the principal defendant. The importance of the Belsen trial derives, however, from the fact that Kramer had previously been, during 1944, the Birkenau camp commander. Kramer's trial was conducted in the autumn of 1945, and was concluded in November, just as the IMT trial was beginning. Kramer was hanged in December 1945. We are fortunate in having the lengthy first statement that Kramer made in reply to British interrogation. The importance of this statement lies in the fact that it was made before any general realization developed among Germans, that the Allied courts were completely serious, and immovable, on the question of the reality of the exterminations. It might have been made within about a month after the capture of Belsen, but this is not certain. There is little courtroom logic playing a role in Kramer's first statement, and for this reason it is reproduced here in Appendix D. Kramer's story was completely in accord with what we have presented here, meaning there were crematories in all of the concentration camps. Some had rather high death rates, especially Auschwitz, which required relatively extensive cremation facilities, because it was also a huge camp. His statement is quite frank regarding the more unhappy features of the camps, and is as accurate a description of the camps as we are likely to get. In regard to atrocities, he firmly asserted, quote, "I have heard of the allegations of former prisoners in Auschwitz referring to a gas chamber there, the mass executions and whippings, the cruelty of the guards employed, and that all this took place either in my presence or with my knowledge. All I can say to all this is that it is untrue from beginning to end," unquote. Kramer later retreated from this firm stand and made a second statement, also reproduced in Appendix D, in which he testified to the existence of a gas chamber at Auschwitz, adding that he had no responsibility in this connection, and that the exterminations were under the direct control of the Central Camp Administration at Auschwitz I. At his trial, Kramer offered two reasons for the discrepancy between his two statements, quote, "The first is that in the first statement I was told that the prisoners alleged that these gas chambers were under my command, and the second and main reason was that Pole, who spoke to me, took my word of honor that I should be silent, and should not tell anybody at all about the existence of the gas chambers. When I made my first statement, I felt still bound by this word of honor which I had given. When I made the second statement in prison, in cell, these persons to whom I felt bound in honor, Adolf Hitler and Reichsfuhrer Himmler, were no longer alive, and I thought then that I was no longer bound," unquote. The absurdity of this explanation, that in the early stages of his interrogations, Kramer was attempting to maintain the secrecy of things that his interrogators were repeating to him endlessly, and which by then filled the Allied press, did not deter Kramer and his lawyer from offering it in court. The logic of Kramer's defense was at base identical to that of Morgan's testimony. Kramer was in the position of attempting to present some story, absolving himself from implication in mass murder at Birkenau. The truth that Birkenau was not an extermination camp had no chance of being accepted by the court. That was a political impossibility. To have taken the truth as his position would have been heroic for Kramer but also suicidal, because it would have amounted to making no defense at all in connection with his role at the Birkenau camp. Even if he had felt personally heroic, there were powerful arguments against such heroism. His family, like all German families of the time, was desperate and needed him. If, Despite all this, he persisted in his heroism. His lawyer would not have cooperated. No lawyer will consciously choose a suicidal strategy when one having some possibility of success is evident. Kramer's defense, therefore, was that he had no personal involvement in the exterminations at Birkenau. Huss and the RSHA did it. Remember that these proceedings were organized by lawyers seeking favorable verdicts, not by historians seeking the truth about events. An incidental matter is the claim that Kramer, as commandant at Notzweiler, had had 80 people gassed there for purposes of medical experiments. These people had supposedly been selected at Auschwitz by unknown criteria, and then transported to Notzweiler to be killed, because the bodies were needed fresh in nearby Strasbourg. Kramer affirmed this story in his second statement but, because it is, implicitly, but unambiguously denied in his first statement, I am inclined to believe that it is untrue. However, it is quite possible that some people were executed at Notzweiler when somebody else was commandant, and that the bodies were then used at the Anatomical Institute in Strasbourg, which certainly possessed bodies for its research purposes. In any case, the matter is not relevant to an extermination program. Hermann Göring and colleagues at the IMT. The IMT trial is somewhat more complicated to consider, because of the great number of defendants, each one having his own possibilities in regard to excusing himself from any real or imaginary crimes. The trial transcript is not really adequate to study the behavior of the IMT defendants, but the record kept by the Nuremberg prison psychologist, Dr. G. M. Gilbert, and published by him as Nuremberg Diary, supplements the transcript to an extent that is adequate for our purposes. Gilbert's book gives an account of the attitudes and reactions of the IMT defendants, not only at the trial but also in the Nuremberg prison. One cannot be absolutely confident in regard to the accuracy of Gilbert's account. Most of the material consists of summaries of conversations the defendants had in the prison, either with each other or with Gilbert. However, Gilbert took no notes on the spot, and wrote everything down each day from memory. His manuscript was critically examined by a former employee of the Office of War Information and by the prosecutors Jackson and Taylor. Even with the best will and most impartial disposition, Gilbert could not have captured everything with complete accuracy. His book has a general accuracy, but one must be reserved about its details. The IMT defendants were arrested shortly after the German capitulation in May 1945, imprisoned separately, and interrogated and propagandized for 6 months prior to the opening of the IMT trial in November, when they met each other for the first time since the surrender, in some cases, for the first time ever. There are four particularly important observations to make. First, not surprisingly, all except Kaltenbrunner had developed essentially the same defense regarding concentration camp atrocities and exterminations of Jews. Whatever the extent to which they might have actually believed such allegations, it was all the fault of Hitler and Himmler's SS. Kaltenbrunner, sitting as a defendant as a substitute for the dead Himmler, was ill when the trial opened, and did not join the other defendants until the trial was a few weeks old. When he appeared, the other defendants shunned him, and he said very little to the others during the course of the next 10 months. The second observation is not quite so expected. Indeed, it may be mildly startling. With the exception of Kaltenbrunner and perhaps one or two others, these high-ranking German officials did not understand the catastrophic conditions in the camps that accompanied the German collapse, and which were the cause of the scenes that were exploited by the Allied propaganda as quote-unquote proof of exterminations. This may appear at first a peculiar claim, but consultation of Gilbert's book shows it to be unquestionably a valid one. The only other possibility is that some merely pretended to misunderstand the situation. The administration of the camps was far removed from the official domains of almost all of the defendants, and they had been subjected to the familiar propaganda since the German surrender. To the extent that they accepted, or pretended to accept, that there had been mass murders, for which Hitler and Himmler were responsible, they were basing their view precisely on the scenes found in the German camps at the end of the war, which they evidently misunderstood or pretended to misunderstand. This is well illustrated by Gilbert's account of an exchange he had with Göring, quote, "Those atrocity films." Göring continued. "Anybody can make an atrocity film if they take corpses out of their graves, and then show a tractor shoving them back in again. You can't brush it off that easily," I replied. "We did find your concentration camps fairly littered with corpses and mass graves. I saw them myself in Dachau. And Hadamar. Oh, but not piled up by the thousands like that. Don't tell me what I didn't see. I saw corpses literally by the carload. Oh, that one train. And piled up like cordwood in the crematorium and half-starved and mutilated prisoners, who told me how the butchery had been going on for years, and Dachau was not the worst by far. You can't shrug off 6 million murders. Well, I doubt if it was 6 million, he said despondently, apparently sorry he had started the argument, but as I've always said, it is sufficient if only 5% of it is true. A glum silence followed, unquote. This is only one example, It is clear from Gilbert's book that, when the subject of concentration camp atrocities came up, the defendants were thinking of the scenes found in the German camps at the end of the war. It is probably not possible to decide which defendants genuinely misunderstood the situation, as Göring did, and which merely pretended to misunderstand, on the calculation that, if one was not involved with concentration camps anyway, it was a far safer course to accept the Allied claims than to automatically involve oneself by contesting the Allied claims. Our third observation is in regard to a calculation that must have figured in the minds of most of the defendants during the trial. It seemed probable, or at least quite possible, to them that the Allies were not completely serious about carrying out executions and long prison sentences. The trial was certainly a novelty, and the defendants were well aware that there was considerable hostility to the war crimes trials in the public opinion of the Allied countries, especially in the US and England. Many must have calculated that their immediate objective should be to say or do whatever seemed necessary to survive the transient wave of post-war hysteria, deferring the setting straight of the record to a not distant future, when a non-hysterical examination of the facts would become possible. Fourth, extermination of Jews was only one of the many accusations involved at Nuremberg. In retrospect, it may appear to have been the main charge, but at the time, the principal accusations in the minds of almost everybody concerned responsibilities for, quote, planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression, unquote, so-called crimes against peace. With the preceding four observations in mind, we can see that the behavior of the defendants during the trial was about what one would expect from a diverse collection of dedicated Nazis, technocrats, conservative Prussian officers, and ordinary politicians. In private, meaning in prison, when court was not in session, the prisoners were just as guarded in their remarks as they were in public, and there was an abundance of mutual recrimination, buck passing, and backbiting. Frank made the worst ass of himself in this respect, but the practice was rather general. The Nazis were not one big happy family. In regard to trial defense strategy, it will suffice to discuss Speer, Göring, and Kaltenbrunner. Speer's trial strategy was simple and also relatively successful, because he did not hang. He claimed that his position did not situate him so as to be able to learn of the various alleged atrocities. Even today, he is permitted to get away with this nonsense. In fact, Speer and his assistants were deeply involved in, for example, the deportations of employable Hungarian Jews in the spring of 1944 for work in underground aircraft factories at Buchenwald. Any rail transport priority given to Hungarian Jews to be exterminated, as opposed to employable Hungarian Jews, would have become known to them, if such had actually happened. If Speer had testified truthfully, he would have declared that he had been so situated that, if an extermination program of the type charged had existed, he would have known of it, and that, to his knowledge, no such program had existed. However, if Speer had testified truthfully, he would have joined his colleagues on the gallows. In his book, Speer gives only one ridiculous piece of evidence that he encountered during the war, that he now says he should have interpreted as suggesting the existence of an extermination program, and that was the suggestion of his friend Karl Honka, who was appointed Himmler's successor as Reichsfuhrer SS by Hitler in the last days of the war, in the summer of 1944, that Speer never, quote, accept an invitation to inspect a concentration camp in Upper Silesia, unquote. Speer also passes along Göring's private remark just before the IMT trial about Jewish survivors in Hungary, quote, so, there are still some there? I thought we had knocked off all of them. Somebody slipped up again, unquote. Such a sarcastic crack was understandable under the circumstances, because Göring never conceded the reality of any extermination program, and insisted that he had known only of a program of emigration and evacuation of Jews from the German sphere in Europe. The introduction to Speer's book, by Eugene Davidson, mentions the fact, noted here on page 153, that many Dutch Jews sent to Birkenau, quote, within sight of the gas chambers, unquote, were unaware of any extermination program. They wrote cheerful letters back to the Netherlands. The remarks about Jewish extermination were not in the original version of Speer's manuscript, they were added at the insistence of the publisher. Unlike the other defendants, Göring assumed throughout the trial that he was to be sentenced to death, and his testimony appears to be the approximate truth as he saw it. Although he never conceded the existence of a program of extermination of Jews, we have seen that he misunderstood what had happened in the German camps at the end of the war, and assumed that Himmler had, indeed, engaged in mass murder in this connection. However, he never conceded any number of murders approaching 6 million. An incidental remark that should be made in connection with Göring is that he was not, as legend asserts, and as Speer claimed in private on several occasions during the IMT, a drug addict. The Nuremberg prison psychiatrist, Douglas Kelly, has attempted to set the record straight in this regard. Göring was a military man, had been an air ace in World War I, and had been the last commander of the Flying Circus of von Richthofen, the Red Baron. Refusing to surrender his unit to the Allies at the end of the war, he returned to Germany, and found himself a hero without a profession. Eventually joining the Nazi Party, he naturally, as a holder of the Pour le Mérite, Germany's highest military decoration, soon became a leader of the small party. As such, he was a leader of the Putsch of 1923, in which he was wounded in the right thigh. The wound developed an infection which caused him to be hospitalized for a long while, during which time he was injected with considerable amounts of morphine. He developed a mild addiction but cured it shortly after being released from the hospital in 1924. Much later, in 1937, Göring developed a condition of aching teeth and began taking tablets of pericodine, a very mild morphine derivative that was a common prescription for his condition, and he continued to take the pericodine throughout the war. His addiction for, or, more exactly, habit of taking these pericodine tablets was not severe, because he was taken off them before the IMT by Dr. Kelly, who employed a simple withdrawal method involving daily reductions of the dosage. To return to the IMT defendants, Kaltenbrunner's position seems to us today to have been somewhat hopeless, and it is probable that his lawyer felt the same way, but he nevertheless had to present some sort of defense, and his defense on the matters that we are interested in, rested on two main points. The first point was that he was head of the RSHA, which was charged with security, and not the head of the WVHA, which administered the concentration camps. He thus claimed that he had almost nothing to do with the camps. The only known instance of Kaltenbrunner's involvement with the internal operation of the camps was in his order of March 1945, concerning permission for the Red Cross to establish itself in the camps. How he assumed authority for giving this order we do not know. He made a great deal of this matter in his defense and, rather than setting the record straight in regard to the catastrophic conditions in the camps at the end of the war, he inflated his action in connection with the Red Cross, to make it appear to be an act against concentration camps as such, which, of course, he had always deplored anyway, he said. Kaltenbrunner's second point was that, as everybody would agree, it was his predecessor Heydrich, and not he, who had organized the details of the Jewish policy, whatever that policy was. He took over the RSHA in 1943, with a directive from Himmler to build up the intelligence service of the SD, a fact which he distorted in claiming that, under the new arrangement, in which Himmler was not going to allow anybody to grow to the stature that Heydrich had attained, Kaltenbrunner was to concern himself only with intelligence, and not to have any control over the police and security functions of the RSHA, in particular the Gestapo, which sent political prisoners to the camps and also, through Eichmann's office, administered the Jewish deportations. Thus, according to Kaltenbrunner, there was no respect in which he could be held responsible for exterminations of Jews that, he conceded, had taken place just as the Allies charged, except that they had started, according to Kaltenbrunner, in 1940. Indeed, according to him, it was not until the summer of 1943 that he learned of the extermination program that Eichmann of his department was conducting. He learned from the foreign press and the enemy radio. He got Himmler to admit it early in 1944 and then protested, first to Hitler, then to Himmler. The extermination program was stopped in October 1944, quote, chiefly due to his intervention, unquote. The manner in which Kaltenbrunner claimed to have learned of the exterminations, while nonsense, is nevertheless consistent with the extreme secrecy that is always said to have been maintained in connection with the extermination program. Kaltenbrunner's story was complete rubbish, but this fact should not blind us to the serious character of this testimony as defense strategy. Suppose that Kaltenbrunner had testified that no extermination program had existed. In such a case, any leniency shown by the court in the judgment would have been tantamount to that court's conceding the untruth, or possible untruth, of the extermination claim, a political impossibility. By claiming that, while the extermination program had existed, Kaltenbrunner had had no responsibility and had even opposed it, the defense was making it politically possible for the court to be lenient in some sense, or was at least making a serious attempt along this line. A few seconds' reflection reveals that this was the only possible strategy for Kaltenbrunner on the extermination charge. The trial was obviously going to end with some death sentences, some acquittals, and some in-between dispositions of cases. This was necessary in order to give it the semblance of a real trial. Thus, on analysis, we see that there was perfectly sound lawyer's logic operating in Kaltenbrunner's defense. That the specific story presented was unbelievable, was not very important from this point of view. The manner in which facts have been treated in connection with these matters has been endless nonsense anyway. The case of Speer shows that a nonsensical story not only had a chance of being accepted by the IMT, but also by general opinion much later, when there should have been adequate opportunity to see matters clearly. The ordinary person, and even the informed critic, can easily fail to understand the significance of such things as the Kaltenbrunner testimony, because he fails to grasp the perspective of the defendants, who did not have the historical interests in these trials that we have. Their necks were at stake, and they regarded the trials, quite correctly, as a manifestation of hysteria. Attempting to save their necks meant devising trial strategies to suit the prevailing conditions, and no optimum trial strategy seeks to move the court on matters on which the court is immovable. This also happens in ordinary legal proceedings. Once something had been decided, it had been decided, and the lawyers organized their cases accordingly. Of course, it is deplorable that Nazis or anyone else should lie in order to promote their personal interests. I have seen scholars tell lies almost as big, just to pick up an extra bit of summer salary, and that too is deplorable. Oswald Pohl at Nuremberg. At Kramer's trial and at the IMT, the courts were effectively committed a priori to the conclusion that Nazi Germany had had a program of exterminating Jews. At the later NMT trials, the courts were committed a priori as a formal matter, on account of the legal constraint previously noted, page 49, that statements made in the IMT judgment constituted, quote, proof of the fact stated, unquote. The IMT judgment said that millions had been exterminated in German concentration camps, particularly at Auschwitz, which was, quote, set aside for this main purpose, unquote. Specifically, 400,000 Hungarian Jews were said to have been murdered there. Thus, defendants and witnesses at the NMT faced a situation similar to that faced by earlier defendants and witnesses, except that it was formalized. Prosecutors were known to redirect the attentions of judges to this legal constraint, when there seemed a chance of its being overlooked. Here we will take special note of only two cases. Defendant Pohl, of course, did not deny the extermination program. In denying personal involvement in the exterminations, he took advantage of the fact that the Allied charges had naturally been directed at the Gestapo and the SD functions of the SS, which were not in Pohl's domain as head of the WVHA. Even the Hus affidavit and testimony explicitly support him in this position. After all, whoever heard of the Wirtschaftsverwaltungshauptamt? Nevertheless, Pohl was hanged. The testimony of Munch, a doctor at Auschwitz, is of some interest. He appeared as a defense witness at the Farben trial, having previously been acquitted by a Polish court. This is the witness whom prosecution lawyer Minskoff asked about the leaflets dropped at Auschwitz by Allied planes, page 155. While Munch testified that he had known about the exterminations while he was at Auschwitz, and had even witnessed a gassing, he also testified that people outside the Auschwitz area, that is those in Germany, did not know. Also, the whole thing was arranged quote-unquote masterfully so that, quote, someone who visited a plant in Auschwitz twice or three times a year for a period of 1 or 2 days, unquote, would not learn of the exterminations. Almost all of the defendants, of course, were in the category of those who could not have known, according to Munch, but he did not stop there. He also asserted that, while all of the SS men and prisoners knew of the exterminations, they did not talk to civilians about them for fear of punishment. For example, Farben engineer Faust, whom Munch knew very well at Auschwitz, did not know about the exterminations. Munch also remarked several times that all one could perceive of the exterminations was the odor, quote-unquote perceptible everywhere, of the cremations. Nobody at this trial of chemical engineering experts bothered to point out that the chemical industry of the area also created a bit of an odor. An odd feature of Munch's testimony is his placing of the crematories and the gas chambers, quote, 1 or 1.5 kilometers southwest of the Birkenau camp, camouflaged in a small woods, unquote. The Munch testimony is merely another illustration of the manner in which defense cases were formulated. The strategy was to avoid contesting things that the courts were already decided on, but to present stories exonerating defendants of personal responsibility. Thus, it was invariably claimed that the extermination program had features that happened to excuse the relevant defendants, but by claiming that such features of the program existed, it was obviously necessary to claim also that the program itself existed. Adolf Eichmann. The next trial that is worth examination is the Eichmann trial. It will be recalled that Adolf Eichmann was illegally abducted from Buenos Aires in May 1960 by Israeli agents, who sent him to Israel to become the victim of a quote-unquote trial that was to break all records for illegality, because the state conducting the trial had not even existed at the time of the alleged crimes. The illegal courtroom proceedings opened in Jerusalem on April 11, 1961, the Jewish court pronounced the death sentence on December 15, 1961. And the murder was carried out on May 31, 1962. In order to understand Eichmann's defense strategy, consider his situation prior to the trial, as a lawyer would have seen it. It was basically a political situation involving an Israeli determination to stage a show trial. In capturing Eichmann, Israel had spat on Argentine sovereignty and, from a lawyer's point of view, the only hope of securing a favorable verdict, a prison sentence to be later commuted, depended upon world opinion developing, so as to encourage Israel to temper its arrogance somewhat with a magnanimous gesture. However, the possibility of such an outcome depended upon presenting a defense, whose fundamental acceptance by the Jerusalem court would have been within the realm of political possibility. Thus, just as with the Nuremberg defendants, Eichmann's only possible defense under the circumstances was to deny personal responsibility. Eichmann conceded the existence of an extermination program, and the first edition of Reitlinger's book was accepted by both sides as approximately descriptive of what had happened. Eichmann's fundamental defense, thus, was that he had merely organized the transports of Jews in obedience to orders that could not be disobeyed. In one respect, his defense was partially successful, for his accurate picture of himself as a mere cog in a machine has been more or less universally accepted by those who have studied and written about this trial, for example Hannah Arendt's book. Actually, Eichmann inflated himself a bit beyond cog status, for a secondary feature of his testimony is that he claimed that he, Eichmann, had done whatever a person as lowly as he could do, in order to sabotage the extermination program, and his interpretations of the meanings of many of the documents used in the trial were obviously strained in this respect. A good example was Eichmann's commentary on two particular documents. The first document was a complaint by the commander of the Wutsch resettlement camp, dated September 24, 1941, complaining of overcrowding at the camp due to tremendous transports of Jews that were pouring in, quote, "And now they face me with a fait accompli, as it were, that I have to absorb 20,000 Jews into the ghetto within the shortest possible period of time, but further that I have to absorb 5,000 gypsies," unquote. The letter is addressed to the local head of government. The second document is a letter by that local head, dated October 9, 1941, passing on the complaint to Berlin, and adding that Eichmann had acted like a horse dealer in sending the Jewish transport to Wutsch, for, contrary to Eichmann's claim, the transport had not been approved. Eichmann's Jerusalem testimony in regard to these documents was that there were only two places he could have shipped the Jews to, the East, where he was supposed to send them, he said, or Wutsch. However, according to him, there were exterminations in the East at that time, but none at Wutsch. Being in strong disapproval of the exterminations, and doing everything that his low office permitted to thwart them, he shipped the Jews to Wutsch despite the inadequate preparations there. This feature of Eichmann's defense strategy is also illustrated by his testimony regarding the Trucks for Hungarian Jews proposals of 1944. He naturally attempted to represent efforts on the German side to conclude the deal, as being due in no small measure to the force of his initiative, motivated, again, by Eichmann's desire to save Jews. It is worth mentioning that the major thrust of the prosecution's cross-examination of Eichmann did not treat wartime events directly. The prosecution's chief effort was to hold Eichmann, in court, to whatever he was supposed to have said to Israeli interrogators during his year of imprisonment prior to the trial, and also to what he was supposed to have said to one Sossen in Argentina in 1957. According to Eichmann's testimony, he encountered Sossen, an ex-SS man, in Buenos Aires in 1955. At this time, Eichmann was, except within tiny circles, a very much forgotten man. The Eichmann-Sossen relationship eventually led to a project to write a book on the persecutions of the Jews during the war. The book, to be completed and promoted by Sossen, was to be based on tape-recorded question-and-answer sessions with Eichmann, but according to Eichmann's testimony, the original form of these sessions could not be retained, quote, "When these questions were put to me, I had to reply from time to time, that I did not remember and did not know, but, obviously, this was not the way to write a book, and then it was agreed that it did not really matter what I remembered, the main thing was to describe the events as they had happened. Then we spoke about poetic license, about license for journalists and authors, which would entitle us to describe the events, even if I did not remember certain details, the essence which would remain, would be a description of the events as they had taken place, and this is really what was eventually taken down. Sossen told me to say something about every point, so that the necessary quantity be obtained. It was also agreed that he, Sossen, would then formulate everything in the form of a book, and we would be co-authors in this book," unquote. Sossen's material eventually appeared, in the autumn of 1960, in Life magazine, so it is clear that Sossen's sessions with Eichmann were designed for the primary purpose of producing a marketable book, as distinct from a historical one. Eichmann obviously planned to acquire a share of the profits, but this testimony does not shed any light onto the specific financial expectations that Eichmann and Sossen had. Sossen transcribed some of the tape-recorded material into typewritten form, and Eichmann added comments and corrections in the margins of some of the pages in his own hand. He also composed 83 full pages of handwritten comments. After the appearance of the Life articles, the prosecution obtained material from Sossen, namely a photostat of a 300-page typewritten document with marginal comments, apparently in Eichmann's hand, purporting to be a transcript of 62 of 67 tape-recorded sessions, and also a photostat of what was said to be the 83-page document in Eichmann's hand. Original documents were evidently not procured, thus raising the possibility of tampering and editing, especially in the case of the 300-page document. In regard to the original tapes, the prosecution commented, quote, "We do not know about the tapes themselves. I don't know whether the people who took part in this conversation kept the tape, or whether the tape was erased and reused for other recordings," unquote. The defense challenged the accuracy of the documents, claimed that the majority of marginal corrections were not included in the document, and further claimed that if Sossin himself could be brought to court to testify, it could be proved that, quote, he changed and distorted what was said by the accused, to suit his own aims. He wanted to produce a propaganda book, this can be proved, how the words were distorted, unquote. However, the prosecution assured the court that if Sossin were to come to Israel, he would be put on trial for his SS membership. The court decided to admit the photostats of the 83 pages in Eichmann's hand, but the prosecution, finding during the course of the rest of the trial that there was virtually nothing in the 83 pages that it could use, made another bid very late in the trial, and finally managed to get accepted into evidence the excerpts of the typewritten document which carried handwritten corrections. Life magazine, which apparently received the same material from Sossin, treated all of it as unquestionably authentic. We close this short discussion of the Eichmann trial by reporting Eichmann's reaction to the allegation, widely publicized, that at the end of the war he had declared that he would, quote, jump gladly into the grave, unquote, with the knowledge that 5 or 6 million Jews had been killed. Eichmann testified that he had, indeed, made a bitter remark such as this to his staff at the end of the war, but that the 5 million killed were not Jews but enemies of the Reich, meaning enemy soldiers, principally Russians. While his defense strategy entailed not contesting the general reality of the extermination program, he insisted that he was in no position to know even the approximate number of Jews killed, and that all remarks attributed to him in this connection, for example Hottel's affidavit, are falsely attributed. West German trials. The trials held in West Germany during the 60s are barely worth mentioning and, moreover, rather difficult to study, on account of the obscurity of the defendants involved. The most publicized, of course, was the Auschwitz trial of 1963-1965, and a few words are perhaps in order. This group of war crimes trials, of which the Auschwitz trial was the most prominent, was held for political reasons, in the aftermath of the hysterical publicity surrounding the capture of Adolf Eichmann. One of the first victims was Richard Baer, successor to Höss and last commandant of Auschwitz, who was arrested on December 20, 1960, near Hamburg, where he was working as a lumberjack. He was imprisoned and interrogated in prison, and insisted that the Auschwitz gas chambers were a myth. Unfortunately, he did not live to take this position in court, because he died in prison on June 17, 1963, at the age of 51, apparently from a circulatory ailment, although his wife considered his death rather mysterious. When the trial finally opened in Frankfurt in December 1963, the principal defendant was one Robert K. L. Mulke, an ex-SS captain who had served briefly as adjutant to Höss at Auschwitz. Mulke had been tried and sentenced by a German chamber immediately after the war in connection with his role at Auschwitz, and quite a few of the other 21 defendants at the Auschwitz trial were standing trial for the second time on basically the same charges. The court, of course, did not ignore legal matters entirely, and it took the trouble to explain that the Bonn government considers itself the legal successor to the Third Reich, and thus, it was competent to try persons for infringing laws that were in force in Germany during the war. Killing Jews, of course, had been illegal in Nazi Germany, and thus, the majority of the defendants were charged in that respect. In regard to the reasonableness of such a trial, one can do not better than to quote from the opinion of the Frankfurt court itself, quote, "This determination of guilt has, however, confronted the court with extraordinarily difficult problems. Except for a few not very valuable documents, almost exclusively only witness testimonies were available to the court for the reconstruction of the deeds of the defendants. It is an experience of criminology that witness testimony is not among the best of evidence. This is even more the case if the testimony of the witness refers to an incident which had been observed 20 years or more ago, under conditions of unspeakable grief and anguish. Even the ideal witness, who only wishes to tell the truth and takes pains to explore his memory, is prone to have many memory gaps after 20 years. He risks the danger of projecting onto other persons things which he actually has experienced himself, and of assuming as his own experiences things, which were related to him by others in this terrible milieu. In this way he risks the danger of confusing the times and places of his experiences. It has certainly been for the witnesses an unreasonable demand for us to question them today, concerning all details of their experiences. It is asking too much of the witnesses if we today, after 20 years, still wish to know when, where and how, in detail, who did what. On this basis, astonishment was repeatedly expressed by the witnesses, that we asked them for such a precise reconstruction of the past occurrences. It was obviously the duty of the defense to ask about those details. And it is unjust to impute to the defense that it wished to make these witnesses appear ridiculous. On the contrary, we must call to mind only once, what endless detail work is performed in a murder trial in our days, how, out of small mosaic-like pieces, the picture of the true occurrences at the moment of the murder is put together. There is available for the court's deliberations above all the corpse, the record of the post-mortem examination, the expert opinions of specialists on the causes of death, and the day on which the deed must have occurred, and the manner in which the death occurred. There is available the murder weapon and fingerprints to identify the perpetrator, there are footprints he left behind as he entered the house of the slain, and many more details at hand, which provide absolute proof to the court that this person was done to death by a definite perpetrator of the deed. All this was missing in this trial. We have no absolute evidence for the individual killings, we have only the witness testimonies. However, sometimes these testimonies were not as exact and precise as is necessary in a murder trial. If therefore the witnesses were asked, in which year or month an event happened, it was entirely necessary for the determination of the truth. And these dates sometimes presented to the court the only evidence for the purpose of determining whether the event related by the witness did in fact happen as the witness related it, or whether the witness had committed an error or confused victims. The court was naturally aware that it was an extraordinary burden for the witnesses, in view of the camp conditions, where no calendars, clocks, or even primitive means of keeping records were available, to be asked to relate in all details what they experienced at the time. Nevertheless, the court had to be able to determine whether an individual defendant did in fact commit a real murder, and when and where. That is required by the penal code. This was an ordinary criminal trial, whatever its background. The court could only judge according to the laws it is sworn to uphold, and these laws require the precise determination of the concrete guilt of an accused, on both the objective and subjective side. The overburdening of the witnesses shows how endlessly difficult it is to ascertain and portray concrete events after 20 years. We have heard witnesses who at first appeared so reliable to the court that we even issued arrest warrants on their declarations. However, in exhaustive examination of the witness declarations in hours-long deliberations, it was found that these declarations were not absolutely sound and did not absolutely correspond to objective truth. For this purpose, certain times had to be ascertained and documents re-examined, whether the accused, who was charged by a witness, was at the camp Auschwitz at all at the time in question, whether he could have committed the deed there, or whether the witness perhaps projected the deed onto the wrong person. In view of this weakness of witness testimony, and I speak now only of the sworn witnesses whose desire for the truth, the subjective and objective truth, the court was thoroughly confident of, the court especially had to examine the witness testimonies. Only a few weeks ago, we read in the newspapers that a member of the Buchenwald concentration camp staff had been convicted of murdering an inmate who, it is clear today, is alive and was certainly not murdered. Such examples should make us think. These cases of miscarriages of justice do not serve to strengthen the respect for the law. On these grounds also, the court has avoided whatever could even in the most remote sense suggest a summary verdict. The court had examined every single declaration of each of the witnesses with great care and all earnestness, and consequently is unable to arrive at verdicts of guilty on a whole list of charges, since secure grounds could not be found for such verdicts. The possibilities of verifying the witness declarations were very limited. All traces of deeds were destroyed. Documents which could have given the court important assistance had been burned, unquote. Although these admissions on the part of the Frankfurt court should be conclusive in forming one's opinion of such trials, we must add that the court understated the facts of the situation. The great majority of the witnesses were citizens of Soviet bloc countries, with all that such a fact implies regarding their testimonies. The court complained that, quote, this witness testimony was not so accurate and precise as is desirable, unquote, but one should observe that it was certainly attempted to organize the memories of the witnesses suitably, for the Comité International d'Auschwitz had set up its headquarters in Frankfurt, and from there had issued information sheets on the terrible things that had happened at Auschwitz. These information sheets had been made available too, and had been read by, the witnesses before they testified. There was also a Comité des Cons in circulation, and other persons, for example the mayor of Frankfurt made suggestions to the witnesses of varying degrees of directness and subtlety. The farce extended also into the matters that the court considered in the course of the long trial and the sentences that were imposed. Mulka, found guilty of being second man in the administration of the great extermination camp, of having ordered that cyclone be on at least one occasion, of having been in charge of the motor pool, which transported the condemned, of having handled some of the paperwork dealing with transports, and of having been involved in the construction of the crematories, was sentenced to 14 years at hard labor, but was released less than 4 months later on grounds of ill health. Defendant Franz Hoffmann, ex-SS captain who had been in charge of Auschwitz I, received a life sentence for the simple reason that, although found guilty in connection with exterminations, he had really been tried on a charge of having thrown a bottle at a prisoner, who later died from the head injury received. This incident evidently had a greater impact on the court than mass exterminations, which is not surprising, because the bottle episode could clearly be recognized as the sort of thing that happens in penal institutions. Hoffman was sentenced to life imprisonment, but shortly later released anyway on the grounds of his previous detention. Precedents for the trials? In searching the history books for proceedings comparable to the war crimes trials, it is not suitable to fasten on prior politically motivated trials for precedence. Such trials, for example the trial of Mary, Queen of Scots, lack the hysterical atmosphere of the war crimes trials. Another feature of the usual political trial is that there is generally only one, or at any rate only a few, victims, and the proceedings are not spread over more than two decades. Even the trial of Joan of Arc, which had aspects of hysteria, is not really comparable to the war crimes trials, because only a single person was on trial, but not an entire nation. In determining precedents for the war crimes trials, only the witchcraft trials of Europe's younger days offer satisfactory comparisons. A most important similarity lies in the fact that the accused in witchcraft trials frequently found it expedient in the contexts, in which they found themselves, to go along with the charges to some extent. In fact, in many cases a partial confession offered the only possible trial strategy. One could not deny the very existence of the sorts of Sabbaths that the popular imagination had decided must have existed. When the sentences of the condemned were carried out, one had scenes like this, quote, "On one scaffold stood the condemned sorceresses, a scanty band, and on another the crowd of the reprieved. The repentant heroine, whose confession was read out, stuck at nothing, however wild and improbable. At the Sabbaths they ate children, hashed, and as a second course dead wizards dug up from their graves. Toads dance, talk, complain amorously of their mistress's unkindness, and get the devil to scold them. This latter sees the witch's home with great politeness, lighting the way with the blazing arm of an unbaptized infant, etc., etc." Unquote. The situation was such that one had to feed the fantasies and passions of the judges and the population, and there were even ways of getting ahead by claiming to be a witch, and thus being informed on the activities of certain other witches, knowledgeable on ways of exposing them, etc. The comparison of the war crimes trials with the witchcraft trials is almost perfect. Both involve large numbers of potential victims, and the possibilities for mutual recrimination are boundless. Most important, both take place in an atmosphere of unreality and hysteria. The person who will not disbelieve those who claim that a modern state was exterminating masses of human beings at a center of chemical industry, employing an insecticide, and that the pervasive stench at that site was due to the associated cremations, is the complete 20th century equivalent of the person who, in earlier centuries, believed those who claimed that misfortunes were caused by people who conversed with toads, had intercourse with the devil, etc. Torture? Another important relationship between witchcraft trials and the war crimes trials is that torture of witnesses and defendants played roles in both. Invented testimony at witchcraft trials is usually explained in terms of torture, although our reference employed above points out that mass hysteria also provides a completely effective motivation. We know that some people were tortured in connection with the war crimes trials, and we should therefore consider the problem of the extent to which torture might have accounted for testimony, especially defendant testimony, in support of exterminations. Available evidence indicates that torture was frequently employed in the war crimes trials. We have noted at length, on page 45, the tortures inflicted on German defendants in the Dachau trials. Very similar scenes took place, under British sponsorship, in connection with the Belsen trial, and Joseph Kramer and other defendants were tortured, sometimes to the point where they pleaded to be put to death. On the other hand, it appears that defendants at the IMT were too prominent to torture, although Julius Streicher was an exception, and it is even said that he was forced to eat excrement. Streicher complained at the IMT that he had been beaten up by Negro soldiers after his arrest. On the motion of Prosecutor Jackson, this testimony was stricken from the record because otherwise, quote, the court would have had to conduct an investigation, unquote. Streicher was the editor and publisher of a disreputable and quasi-pornographic magazine Der Stürmer, which attacked not only Jews, Freemasons, and clerics but on occasion even top Nazis. Streicher once claimed in Der Stürmer that Göring's daughter had not been fathered by Göring but by artificial insemination. Der Stürmer was considered offensive by nearly all political leaders in Germany, but Streicher had the protection of Hitler, out of gratitude for Streicher's having delivered Nuremberg to the Nazi Party. In 1940, Göring arranged for Streicher to be put partially out of action. Although Der Stürmer was not suppressed, Streicher was deprived of his party position of Gauleiter of Nuremberg. Streicher never held a position in the German government, before or during the war, and his inclusion in the first row of defendants at the IMT was ludicrous. There was never any general or massive exposé of torture of witnesses and defendants at the NMT trials, but we believe that the fact, noted in the previous chapter, page 219, that the Nuremberg prosecution did not hesitate to torture witnesses even in connection with a regular U.S. legal proceeding, is strong support for our assumption that torture was employed rather commonly at Nuremberg or, more precisely, employed on witnesses and defendants who played roles in the trials at Nuremberg. We are inclined to believe that Adolf Eichmann was not tortured by his Israeli captors, at least not for the purpose of forcing him to give specific trial testimony. This view is based on the simple fact that he did not complain, in his trial testimony, that he had been tortured thus, although he did complain, early in his trial testimony, that he had suffered rather rough treatment during the few days immediately after his capture, particularly when his captors forced him to sign a declaration that he had come to Israel voluntarily, and which the prosecution had the audacity to put into evidence at the trial. However, the extreme secrecy that surrounded Eichmann's imprisonment in Israel allows the possibility that he was tortured in some sense, but that he had tactical or other reasons for not charging torture in his testimony. In considering the problem of torture, it is important to observe that the efficacy of torture in producing testimony having a desired content is rather questionable. We cannot believe that the prosecuting authorities at Nuremberg had any moral compunctions about using torture, but they most probably made the rather obvious observation that, no matter how much you torture a man, you still cannot be absolutely sure what he will say on the witness stand. Exceptions to this statement are provided by the Moscow trials of the 30s and other trials staged by communists, but the defendants in such cases are always brainwashed to the extent that they utterly prostrate themselves before the court when on trial, and denounce themselves as the foulest beings on earth. No such attitude is perceptible in the Nuremberg defendants who, despite much untruthful testimony damaging to the Nazi regime in general, always argued their personal innocence. In examining the torture problem, we must be careful regarding what questions one might ask, and what inferences may be drawn from the answers. Obviously, there is the question of whether or not a man was tortured. Second, there is the question of whether or not he testified to the reality of exterminations. Assuming that affirmative answers apply to both questions, it is a non sequitur to infer that the former accounts for the latter. This is illustrated by the case of Kramer who, despite torture, spoke the truth in his first statement, and evidently only changed his story, when his lawyer explained to him the logical implications of insisting on a story that the court could not possibly accept. On the other hand, if a witness had been tortured, we may infer that the authorities in charge are not to be trusted. Moreover, one must not make assumptions too quickly in regard to the probable motivations that the Nuremberg jailers might have had for employing torture. The motivation need not have been to produce specific testimony, and may have been either more or less thoughtfully conceived. First, torture might have been employed purely to produce pleasure. The Jews in charge hated their German victims. Second, torture may have been employed merely on the basis of the passing observation that, while it was not guaranteed to be helpful, it also could not hurt matters, as long as the proceedings were kept suitably confidential. A third possible motivation, a far more intelligent one, could have been that torture, while not of much use in producing specific pieces of testimony, could be of assistance in a less specific and more general sense. If my interrogator threatens that he will take steps against my family if I do not cooperate, I may doubt him on the basis that I see no evidence that he either has the necessary power or the necessary cruelty or both. However, if he imprisons me for a year or more, torturing at will, I will eventually believe that he is both powerful and cruel. Thus, we see that torture, while indeed inadequate in itself to produce the sort of testimony that was produced at Nuremberg, might very well have been employed to achieve a general softening up of witnesses and defendants that would help the process of coercion and intimidation at other points. A few complications are also worth mentioning. First, physical torture is not such a very well-defined thing. One could argue that extended imprisonment under unhealthy or even merely uncomfortable conditions with daily interrogation is a form of torture. Another complication is that there are modes of torture, mainly sexual in nature or related to sex, that one could never learn about because the victim simply will not talk about them. Finally, we should observe that almost none of us, certainly not this author, has ever experienced torture at the hands of professionals bent on a specific goal, and thus we might suspect, to put it quite directly, that we simply do not know what we are talking about when we discuss the possibilities of torture. Our basic conclusion in respect to the torture problem is that there is something of an imponderable involved. We believe it likely that torture was employed to achieve a general softening up of the victims, so that their testimonies would more predictably take courses that were motivated by considerations other than torture, and we have analyzed witness and defendant testimony in preceding pages of this chapter on this basis. The effects of, and fear of torture do not, in themselves, explain testimony in support of exterminations. We thus tend to disagree with much of the existing literature in this area, which, it seems, places too much weight on the singular efficacy of torture at Nuremberg, although we concede that our analysis of this hard subject is not conclusive. We have similar suspicions that writers on witchcraft trials have also leapt to invalid conclusions on the basis of the two indisputably valid facts that, first, victims in witchcraft trials were tortured and, second, many of these people later testified to impossible happenings. The former does not really account for the latter, but it can be a contributing factor when its effects are added to the more weighty motivations for delivering certain kinds of false testimony.